Bunyan, everyone. This is Professor Brown, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, Africana Studies Department, and retired professor from Compton Community College, former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees for the city of Compton, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees. We want to welcome all viewers, along with my co-host, Joe Hembrick, a longtime educator from Linwood Unified School District, longtime educator and administrator for the Linwood and Compton Unified School District, and first head black coach at Linwood Unified School District for football, as well as developed the Unity Mural at Centennial High School, merging black and brown people together from a historical perspective. Joe Hembrick is a longtime historian dealing with Maat as well as ancient African history. We want to welcome all viewers to this program, a very important program. And I'm so happy that Brother Damien has made it to be a presenter on this program. He's very busy, and I'm honored that he took the time to come and share with us his wealth of knowledge on gentrification. And but the beautiful thing about Damon Goodman and their organization, Crenshaw Subway Community Action Program, I mean, he can explain the name of it. But the point is that they come up with a strategy. They tried to buy the mall. They're buying property. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the problem. It's another thing to do something and come up with a strategy. I want to commend him for being one of the few organizations that really are dealing with solutions and working to do that. So without further delay, and he'll tell you more about himself. I know he's a board member for the community labor. I'm waiting right here. The BCCLA, Black Community Clergy Labor Alliance. And he's an active member in the community, longtime strategist, and has demonstrated and walked into many meetings and demand to be heard. So without further delay, I mean, he speaks truth to power. And he's got a brief story to tell about all the challenges that they have went through and what's going on with gentrification. Without further delay, Damien Goodman.
Barigani Black people, and thank you, Professor Raw, for creating this space and this opportunity for us to talk more about one of the most critical issues facing us as Black people in urban America, and especially here in the Los Angeles region. I have the good pleasure of having met Professor Raw at the Hakalu at the African American Cultural Center under the leadership of Dr. Maulana Karenga, and shortly thereafter, after entering that space for the first time to talk about an issue that related to environmental and transportation justice, I was invited to be part of the newly formed, it's not so new anymore, but at the time, newly formed Black Community Clergy and Labor Alliance, and I've been on that steering committee for I think about 9 years now, which is seeking to bring a Black united front to tackle all types of issues that we are facing as Black people, Black Angelenos, Black people in the LA region. I want to just back up and talk about this journey from advocacy, organizing, and to where we are now operating a ecosystem. If there's one thing we know how to do pretty well, it's how to protest, how to make noise when we see injustice. And that's critically important. No change comes without it. I'll go even further, and especially since it was just Brother Malcolm's birthday just a few days ago, there's no such thing as a nonviolent, bloodless revolution. So at the very least, we have to make some noise if we seek to see this, the system that we operate in, make some changes. We have, and I grew up in Leimert Park, which is in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, Born in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles. I've lived here my entire life, 41 years now, and been in the Leimert Park for about 30 years. And after going around and a few early life ventures, primarily in the political sphere and education, I came home in 2005, 2006, and saw that a transit line was being built through my community that was textbook environmental racism. Compton is home to the Blue Line, which is still the most murderous light rail line in America. And that has to do with an absence of safety protections and shortcomings when that line was being built. And we saw that those same safety issues and environmental noise pollution and segmentation through the division of communities and overall traffic congestion, that those harms would be born in the majority Black and Brown community that the Expo Line was being built through, but would not be born in the Culver City community, where they had valiantly fought appropriately to make sure that there'd be no street crossings in their city. So we called that textbook environmental racism. We saw that our schools were most at risk from having 55 mile per hour trains fly by there without adequate safety measures, leading to potential catastrophic consequences. And we began a valiant campaign to fix Expo and to see that rail line be improved. And we saw many concessions, not by any stretch of the imagination, all that we wanted, but we did start a little bit late on that. And then we got involved in the Crenshaw Line project. While the Exposition Corridor was primarily residential, most people, when you talk about it throughout the nation, don't know it. Everybody knows the Crenshaw Boulevard. When you say Crenshaw Boulevard in Los Angeles, you're talking about Black people. You're talking about Black community. You're talking about the heart of Black commerce and then culture. In the case of Leimert Park Village, our Africatown, consciousness, politics, art. Once again, Metro wanted to build the project inadequately, and we said that's not right. We had three demands. The first was to make sure the rail line was not going to be built unsafely, to see that it be built underground all down Crenshaw Boulevard. And we saw major improvements there from what is now opened and what they were forced to build underground, and added a station at Leimert Park Village. There's a long history of transportation projects being built through and for communities of color. They didn't even want to have a station at the African American Center, and we forced them to do that. Then we saw that we wanted to make sure, and in partnership with the Los Angeles Black Worker Center, that Black people were working on the Metro project. Because I like to say the two hardest places to find a Black man in the city of Los Angeles is at a construction site and a hockey game. And you might see more of them at a hockey game than you will at a construction site. So if the rail line was going through a community that was over 70% Black and Brown and over 50% Black, that it needed to reflect that. We didn't get quite to that, but we got a whole lot more, got a lot better than any Metro project before. And that credit primarily goes to the Black Worker Center. And then the last kind of deals with where we are now, which is where we knew these transit lines could facilitate economic development. While the Blue Line has not necessarily done that in Compton, Watts, Willowbrook, and there are a lot of reasons for that, we wanted to make sure this was not going to be the type of development that displaced us. It wasn't going to be continuing the process of extracting wealth from us and harming us and not really benefiting us. Our statement was quite clearly to ensure that the economic development that is a product of the rail line is based on principles of local economic empowerment and comply with our standards as a community. No bad projects, quality development, development without displacement. And we, challenged Metro on multiple fronts and prepared for, this is in 2010, 11, 12, thought that there'd be some form of economic development, but nothing like we've seen now. In 2017, so to speak, the train had left the station. It was clear that Metro was not going to change the design of the line. And in 2018, we began to become focused, hyper-focused on a similar land use issue, a similar matter of self-determination and the absence of community control and that inability to make sure that the infrastructure that comes in our community is for us yet by our standards, safe, helpful, not harmful, in the form of gentrification. Now, I'm old enough to remember, like literally, I've been in here 30 years, when the fourplex next to me was raided because it was a crack house. And that same building was sold for over $1.5 million just a couple years ago. Things have drastically changed. And we have been intentionally involved in the Crenshaw Subway Coalition and putting together a effort to educate the people about what's taking place collectively, right? Yes, it is real when we see those who are, formerly rolled through our communities with the windows rolled up at 55 miles per hour, who are now walking their dogs and pushing their strollers. Because when they come into the community politics, I guess they just don't know anything short of being colonizers like their ancestors. They don't know how to respect the community. So we have people who question whether the lowriders on Crenshaw Boulevard should be there. We have people who talk about the drum circle, which is a spiritual drum circle that's been there for over 30 years, should quiet down. You know, all these things that we see taking place throughout the communities, and that's real. It's real when you have community associations and block clubs and neighborhood groups that go from focusing on after school programs that our kids need so they can stay alive and off the streets to dog parks. Try and change the agenda on dog parks, where you go from cultivating the amazing spirit and uplift and positive activity in the low riding to trying to push it away, calling it noise pollution and making blowing things out of proportion. That's a real issue because, quite frankly, we just have a lot of people who are sick, and they're sick with this disease called white supremacist mindset, where they think that no matter where they are, no matter how deep the community and its roots and how long things, they can just take it over. That's real. But the big and key driver in this is this combination of public sector and at working at the behest of the private sector to take back communities that they had divested from a long time ago because they know the values are lower, so they can create wealth and they can create space. In the process, they can create harm to people who have always been marginalized. This is not a small battle. We're talking about, when we think about it, the largest financial actors on the planet. Multi-trillion, I'm not misspeaking, multi-trillion dollar private equity firms, hundreds of billion dollar banks that are involved in this intentional cultural erasure, urban cleansing project that is taking place along almost every major coastal city in America and throughout many cities across the world. The few places where they're able to mitigate that is because property is not on the market, meaning it's not as the residential property is not on the market, meaning that it is protected from these speculative investment forces, and or there are strong protections in place for tenants. The key point is that, you know, Los Angeles has a bit higher percentage as a region of Black homeowners than many other places. I mean, there are parts of Houston, like the third world, where it's like less than 15%. Here, we get up into the mid-30s to high 40s when you start talking about View Park, but primarily somewhere in the low to mid-30s. But the vast majority of Black people are susceptible, and Black businesses as well, because most Black businesses don't own their property, and it's been owned by an outside owner for years, and they're at risk of having their rent. There's absolutely no rent control for them. But the vast majority of Black people are living in housing that they do not own. Over 60% in the county, over two-thirds in the city of Los Angeles. And so we are susceptible to those risks of those who come in and say, Becky with the blonde hair is comfortable now walking down Crenshaw because we've over-policed it. We brought in the gang injunctions. We made any time Jose and Andre are standing next to each other in the corner, we can harass them. We've done all of these broken windows and stop and frisk, either in policy or practice. We've implemented that. And so now we've made it comfortable for capital return and for Becky with the blonde hair and the dog and the stroller to walk down. And so now Big Mama's house that was only worth $200,000 and we couldn't even get a second mortgage on it to repair the roof is now worth $1.2 million. I wish I was exaggerating. That's the difference between what we've seen in the last 30 years. We went from affordable home ownership for many to completely unaffordable home ownership for nearly all Black people. And so what we've done as our evolution from Fix Expo to Crenshaw Subway Coalition is intentionally over the last 5 years, hyper-focus on this battle for maintaining our space in place. And then through education, organization, activation, litigation, every Asian that you can think of. And also at the same time, say that we've got to evolve and add to our element this strong advocacy arm, because we know how to do that well, and build on the community power that we have and the community connections do to put together the institutions and instruments so that we can liberate our communities by taking land off of that speculative real estate market and putting it into collective community control. And I have to underscore the point, community control. I'm not talking about Black people control, because Black people can be individuals. And one day Jay-Z is gonna give me a phone call because I put his name out there too much. I'm not talking about making Jay-Z a whole bunch of money so he can be rich and have everything under Jay-Z's control. I'm talking about the true African principle of Ujamaa, cooperative economics, collective decision making, building on the amazing history of Nkrumah and others throughout the history of African socialist movements, of building on our natural, I say that again, our natural inclination to make decisions about community in community, right? This individualistic mindset where we all just have our plots of land and our walls, where we all operate independently. We don't care what anybody else is. That is not African, not at all. That is not indigenous. That is not South American. That is not anything. I think there we go. We have to recognize that is foreign. That is as foreign to us as the white supremacist mindset that intends to be inflicted on us. That we have always been communal. We've always made decisions being concerned about how they affect the whole, not just the individual. And we need to start saying it's actually a bit crazy that we don't. It's that very individualistic white supremacist capitalist mindset that has us on track to climate catastrophe. Earth is going to be okay. It's us that is not. And that is a direct result of decisions being made individually for individual wealth creation of some people. Like George Carlin said, it's a big club and we ain't in it. And for profit over people. The mere concept, people talk about the indigenous people selling Manhattan, at a low cost. It was because at the time, the mere concept of land being under the ownership of anyone other than nature, other than our gods, other than the collective, was foreign. It wasn't as though they were trying to get money. Well, you crazy white man wants to give me money to. No, this is for the people. This is for the community. This is not ours. This is something, and we have a responsibility of storing it. So, in so many respects, this work that we're doing is undoubtedly tied to, yes, securing a safe place for people to be able to, for Black communities and people within Black communities to live, to heal, to grow, to thrive, connected to one another. But it's also, in so many respects, Professor Rob, a intentional effort to unlearn these horrible things that we've been taught in this extractive concept that we've been infused from birth, and get to a much more healthy relationship. Now, for those who maybe 15 years ago thought, oh, this is just radical, this brother's just out there, and good, the 60s done came and went. And well, let me tell you, as the pandemic showed, that the pandemic at its peak, was a dress rehearsal for the climate catastrophe that is coming. Let's be clear. The climate catastrophe that is coming will lead to mass migration, not just from people from other countries, but within America. Florida, Miami as a city will not exist. Large parts of southern Louisiana will not exist. The fires that we experience that take out entire towns within a day, that will become frequent. The food system, the water system, all of that. We're looking toward a future, and it is not pessimistic. It is denialism to deny that we are looking at that type of future, especially if you're my age, especially if you're my age and you have kids. That is the life that we were looking toward, unfortunately, because again, the decisions that have been made that we would continue this industrial revolution and putting capitalism over the planet. And this is a train that can't be stopped, absent massive rebellion and revolution, general strikes. A level of organizing unseen in the world is necessary just for us to be in a little bit more livable situation than is currently projected over the next 20 years or in 20 years and thereafter. And so think about that world where you're literally living with millions of just Americans, let alone people across the world, being in cities that are no longer habitable, having inadequate water systems, food systems down the you already cannot get insurance on your home if you are in southern Louisiana, right? And so, especially for the Black people who have any kind of wealth, having it all be in your home and wiped away by a flood, and FEMA ain't coming. Let's be clear, help is not on the way. And then now match that with the automation and the AI that we're seeing, right? Where, it's not just affecting McDonald's workers, where now I don't eat McDonald's, but I look into them and I see that, all the cashiers have been replaced by machines and now they're working on like fully automated AI machine places. It's not just that. This AI and this automation can take that master's degree that you spend $150,000 on becoming an attorney and look at a contract in minutes and come out with defects within minutes that would otherwise take an attorney a day or at least a half a day. And so you're looking at everything from grocery clerks to creative artists. To doctors, entire swaths, as we are seeing the population increase, entire segments of sectors being unemployed, not being able to make anything, right? Because why would I pay $1,000 an hour for an attorney to review a contract instead of buying this system, this AI system that can do it for $250 forever? If that 250, right? So we're looking at a massive level of disruption that, again, I say the pandemic was solely a dress rehearsal to it. And so when that happens, and it's not a question of if it happens, it is happening now. The AI revolution, the automation revolution is happening now. The climate catastrophe is happening now. Entire cities, entire countries, in some respects, half of countries like Pakistan are under the water and unable to recover. The people are going to have to move. That's happening now, and it's only going to get worse. What are we going to look to? What principles are we going to be drawing from? Because I can guarantee you this individualistic system, we don't think collectively about how we operate in a sustainable fashion, have our own food systems, have our housing be secure in price, have our business space not be susceptible to massive level of increases in rents. If we are not coming back to these communal principles, we're going to have to, like we did when Trump and his that fool Trump wasn't getting checks out fast enough to people, making sure just his criminal friends in on Wall Street and in corporate America got checks, but people on the street were going starving, and a lot of those checks didn't get down to the people who needed them, right? And at that basic level, right, things are going to be disrupted. And so part of this work in what we now call the Liberty Ecosystem, which is this multi-organizational structure that operates or coordinates collectively, and I have the pleasure of being the architect of, is about finding ways in which we can take so much land off the market and put it into this collectively owned community structure known as a community land trust. Finding ways in which we're able to pool the limited capital that we have to support the business enterprises and to support those land acquisitions. So again, it's off the market, building toward restorative and regenerative economies that heal us from the trauma that we've been inflicted upon as Black people within America, and are resilient, that is to say, we're building homes that are off the grid, that are not reliant on being in the dirty fossil fuel energy grid, and so that we can weather these storms and ideally identify collectively food systems and cooperative structures. Like this is you might be hearing for this now for the first time. I don't think y'all are, but this is going to be what everybody's talking about 10 years from now. Not because they're geniuses, but because this is the only way we're going to survive this coming challenge, this trifecta, this evil trifecta. I should say evil, because automation and AI can be good. The question then becomes, do the people who profit off of that automation and AI actually get taxed so that the goods within the social space, the social network, has expanded, which I'm not betting on. I think it's going to really take a revolution to make that happen. But nonetheless, that this combination of things is going to force us to live and operate differently. This whole Reagan vision of America is going to crumble, and there will be people who seek to profit from those disasters, just as they seek to profit from the disaster of war. But I think in the case of our communities, especially those where there is a level of consciousness, we'll be able to build these liberated communities, these liberated zones, as one of our key advisors, Ed Whitfield, calls them, where we're to be much more free, much more secure, and in the process unshackle these white supremacist, patriarchal, heteronomic, parasitic capitalist exchange that we've been in since we were brought here. That's what we're up to, Professor Ron. You're on mute.
Okay, we can start asking some questions. Rashiki, you want to call on people?
I can.
Okay.
Okay, Brother Mashinda.
Yes, okay. Wow. Yeah, thank you for that presentation of deep information, brother. Just a lot, not only a lot to think about, and a lot to prepare for. I'm here in Louisiana, and just listening to, what it reminded me when I was here when Katrina, the hurricane, came through here, and how life changed immediately in terms of, stores closed, everything closed, no gas stations, everything like that. People were eating MREs, those rations. And I said to myself that I wasn't going to eat any rations, but I found myself eating some rations. Of course, we were blessed that some stores started opening up slowly and things like that, But the area that I was in, part of that survival, in the community where I was at, people pulled together and survived together, shared and things like that collectively, so It sounds like a grim outlook in some regard, but I think your message is it's like it's, we have to offset that. We have to, become conscious and understand not only what's possibly in store, but to be prepared, to prepare the communities to, like you say, cooperate together, and knowing that there's an evil force out there that's been in play for a long time, and so pretty much not only salvaging what we have left, but to try to build, from where we are, and as a people. So I just appreciate the presentation. I'm gonna let someone else talk. It's a lot to contemplate, and thank you again.
Santi.
All right, Sister Aziza.
Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you for the presentation and enlightening me and the panel. Other than that, I don't have any questions at this moment.
All right, Sister Making It Happen.
Greetings, family. Hotep to all. I did pop on towards the end, but what I was able to surmise sounds like there's more planning in place, and we have some millennials to help us, guide us through. We have some solid foundation with the professor, Ra here, myself, and some of the other elders, but we definitely need you and the young folks, younger folks, to help us know where we're headed. And so that we can plan properly, so that we can make it through the storm. It's con you know, the battle continues, the war continues. And yeah, we have to take care of ourselves and heal ourselves, and know that we have to come together as a community, families, husbands, wives, children, elders, everybody have to come together, so that we can make it to this next side. Which I have all faith that we will, but we want to get there in good order and be able to sustain and grow with some sustainability in our future for our grandchildren and our children. So I missed it. I heard a little bit, but I'm here. I'm with you. We're present. And so let's go.
Making it happen. All right. Brother Joe. Brother Joe, there.
I'll go, man. I'll go.
Oh, there he is. He's here. Brother Hembrick?
Sir.
Question, comments?
No, not at this time. I hate that the bookstore closed down. Talking about a conscious community, lose your bookstore. Big part of the consciousness. So any sign of that ever returning, or what's going on with that? That's the one.
Yeah, SO1 was a critical space and place for building and creating access to knowledge for our community. And, I think Brother James and his partner, whose name is lapsing right now.
Tom.
Yes. James and Tom ultimately just retired. They did their work, and they wanted to make sure that the incredible work and brand that they had built would be honored. We did try and talk to him about maybe We internally did try and see if there wasn't another book store that we could bring to the area, and those conversations are ongoing. But I don't know if it'll be in that space. There are challenges and complications with that building, to say the least. But it's never been about it being in that building. It's been about being in the community. And so, yeah, there are various entities and groups that are on that front. If they want to reach out to me, we're happy to assist. or do what we can from an advisory perspective. But yeah, we need a lot of things in our community, but we also have a lot of things in the community, right? Because it wasn't just Esiwan, it was also Dawo down the street when he passed at the corner of 48th and Crenshaw. And there are some others that are operating kind of quietly, in part because they don't want to get gentrified or they don't want to be a source of gentrification. A Revolutionary Bookstore, which is in Jefferson Park, but we do need something a little bit more local. We can't get over what a good bookstore, a good convening place can do for building community.
You ready for me, Rasha Key?
Yes, sir.
Okay. First of all, again, Damon, thanks for taking the time. I know you work all day and all night on these projects and meeting and talking to people. And your work is paying off. Believe me, it's admired by BCCLA and everybody in the Murph Park area and all the efforts your organizations and your people have put together as an example. When you say about the consciousness of AI and climate change, do you see the masses being aware of the coming of those things?
Well, I think it's a couple things. The first is AI is literally evolving now, practically on a biweekly basis. Every 2 weeks, there's another major development, to the point that people are now, I think even the White House has called some of the leading folks that are in control of that space to consider creating some guardrails and putting some pauses on some things, because it has got the potential in the wrong hands. And I'd argue that some of these criminals in tech, or I shouldn't say it that way, I should say some of these people in tech are doing things that otherwise would be considered criminal if they were in another industry. It might already be in the bad and wrong hands. So I think in general, we're still catching up. I personally spend a lot of time paying attention to it just for efficiency and operations, but also to get a better understanding and educate myself about how this is going to change the economy, how people are going to use it to adapt, to expand their service providing and improve what they're doing, and how those who are typically not skilled in this space will be affected, to ensure that they're collectively being considered as we talk about this evolution. And so regardless as to whether it's the what type of AI is or what type of automation, what I really emphasize with people or I want to emphasize and underscore is that there have been multiple technological revolutions, right? The number of people it takes to build a car today is very different than the number of people it took to build a car 30 years ago, which is very different from the number of people build a car 60 years ago, right? Again, lead to an end to an entire industry. This is a little bit more disruptive because it's across the board. This is like almost to the level of the development of free trade, where entire factories ended up being pulled from our communities and put into other areas there where people could be exploited and then sold to us, right? That level of disruption, only on a much bigger scale and not just affecting blue collar jobs, really affecting everything. No collar, blue collar, white collar. That is how disruptive this technology is. And it's like, I'm not telling people to resist it. I'm telling people to prepare for it, right? It's a reality, much as climate catastrophe is a reality. While I would love, and I actually sometimes often think we all, every activist just needs to stop and shut down capitalism, because that is the only way we will respond to climate catastrophe. This is a train that cannot be moved. We are a consumer society. It is not sane that we are building a single new car today of any type, any type. We should be talking, much as they do in Cuba, right, about how we're able to alter if there is still to be a vehicle each internal combustion engine into something that can run off of electricity. And talking about our infrastructure and grid as being completely electric, right? That's if we cared, right? But the fact that we're still building new cars, let alone building new cars with an internal combustion engine, just tells you how far off we are. People are not going to make the change, and it's not going to hit them until the floodwaters hit you, like Katrina, where you can't work and you're unemployed and you're sick and you can't go out, like the pandemic, right? These are real realities coming. And sadly, you know, unlike the pandemic, which, you know, was nature made, you can't argue that Katrina was nature made because they knew the levees were poorly solidified, but you can somewhat put that on nature. But the pandemic, you know, we had a very human response, and things that we said had always been said were impossible for years suddenly became possible. You can't just give people money. Yes, you can. You can't just create universal unemployment and allow people to actually get enough money to food stamps so they can feed themselves. Yes, you can. Right. And so I worry about that reality and making sure people are aware of what it means as to the direction we're going. Yes, they need to be on the street. They need to be part of the revolution. And the only solution is revolution.
Yeah, I understand that. It seems as if a lot of the masses are unaware
100%
of the future you're projecting. I don't see schools, colleges developing curriculums around climate change or classes around climate change and or around AI, the positives and negatives. And I don't see churches talking about it, that they're trying to be gods or anything. They can tie it into their sermons and things of this nature. So there's not really a movement of consciousness of that to come. But the next question is, when you're dealing with a liberated zone, what does that mean?
It's a place where people can, especially those that are marginalized, can live, grow, thrive, and breathe simply free of those, you know, parasitic influences and exploitation. It is housing that you can afford. It is having all that you need to be able to have the basic necessities of life. Make sure you have a decent paying job, right? And that's often done not by being in an industry that is extractive, where the boss makes all the money and maybe kicks some down to the workers, but where workers ideally collectively own the enterprise or collectively benefit from the profits developed by the enterprise and have, if not union level benefits, something on the way towards that. It's a space where, you know, you can't forget the education element, but where people are being taught and educated and the incredible creative energy with them is being cultivated, right? It's just, you know, it's so foreign for some people to do that often one of the amazing learning tactics I was taught was for people to close their eyes and imagine what a liberated community would be. And to articulate that. Okay, we're so used to being, we're so used to having this foot on our neck. We, that just simply breathing is considered good. But I want people to understand and start imagining and believing what would be possible if we were able to stand and breathe healthy air and have all that we needed. And how do we get there? Right, it's by controlling our land. It's by having non-extractive resources. It's by having the spiritual and the health programming that heals the damages that exist, that has been inflicted upon us, just as Black people in America, let alone the many other things that we have. And it is being in community and connected to one another, not having to live isolated. So finding intentional ways in which we're able to look and see and connect. It's such a beautiful space. And again, Whitfield has a better term. He calls it liberated zones, which I believe you can find by Googling.
Okay. The other question is that rebuilding the Vision Theater or remodeling it, what effect do you think that's going to have in the Leimert Park area?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one, when people ask me when it's going to open, I say it's easier for me to project when the second coming of Jesus is than to when that Vision Theater is going to open. Because it has been forever and a day since it was supposed to be open. It was not the pandemic. This thing was supposed to be open like 5 years ago. I think depending upon who has the operations of it and whether it is a group that's really community centered, really open and responsive to it versus a corporation or a big name will determine its fate. But it's an amazing endeavor that has taken way too long. I continue to be frustrated because our headquarters is right across the street from it. And I can count on one hand the number of Black people I've seen working on the site. And I'm just saying, if that was the Japanese-American theater and you didn't see any Japanese-Americans that had the contract and working on it, you'd probably have hell. If it was the Mexican-American theater and you didn't see Mexicans working on it, you'd probably have hell. But when in our community, in our Black community, contract can go to a not Black contractor who can not hire Black people for what is to be the center of Black arts space in Los Angeles, the most public display of it. So I think ultimately, you know, it will attract a lot of traveling plays and other artistic expressions and new traffic into the area. But how it operates and whether it is a benefit to the community is going to be completely reliant on who the operator is, who the selected operator is. And the person who will make that decision ultimately will be the councilwoman, the current councilwoman, Heather Hutt.
Okay. Now, when it comes down to the challenges of gentrification, your organization has been working on that and educating people to that. And it's not just in Leimert Park, it's wherever Black and brown people live. What are some of the solutions as the organization that y'all have put forward?
Yeah. That's a really good question. And so what I try to get people to understand is that there is so much, there is such a great need for, well, let me say it this way. That nothing that I that you will help me propose, or nothing that you will, 95% of what you will hear me propose, what 95% of what you would hear anyone propose, or any organizational leader, right? There's a difference between being an issue expert, an activist, versus having a base of people who you have collectively worked with to identify challenges and work on challenges to identify solutions. And I would like to put myself in the category of primarily being an organizational leader, given the work that we've done. There's nothing that an organizational leader or organization will articulate that has not already been articulated to our elected officials, including Black. And I got to say, Black is, we have more, you know, 9 out of 10 Black elected officials are descriptively Black and not authentically Black. You know what I'm talking about, Professor Ron.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we got Black people who are the mayors of the 4, or is it now 5 largest cities in America? And I can guarantee you, in one of the major entities, what Eric Adams and what London Breed do on a daily basis, if they were white, the NAACP would be calling, and I'm saying that from a more tame organization, not a more radical organization, not that I'm saying NAACP is tame, but the NAACP would be calling them out. But because they're descriptively Black, they get to do things that are harmful to Black people on a daily basis. But, you know, one's a cop and the other came in being paid for by big tech. So what do you expect? It's who put them in office. And so, you know, ultimately the solutions are as simple as taking, as it can be put into 2 primary categories. One is creating the protective structures, or putting the protective systems and structures in place that don't allow those that seek to exploit our communities and increase housing insecurities to operate, right? And so when we say take as much land off of the speculative real estate market as possible and bring it into ideally community control, when you do that, then it's that land is protected from the speculative vultures, be they BlackRock, which is a $9 trillion private equity firm that is financed primarily by our own tax dollars, our own pension dollars, excuse me. You know, major institutions like the University of California, California CalPERS, which I think you're a member of. You'd be surprised, Professor Ra, how much of your pension goes into entities like BlackRock to do harmful investing in businesses that do harm to Black people, do harm to public sector workers, do harm to the very people with whose dollars they are receiving, or it's harm just from small speculative investors, those that end up knocking on grandmother's door, providing them bob and dollar and harassing them until they sell and taking advantage of them if their mental faculties start to wane in their elder years, right? Got to protect that. And then for the vast majority of us that have to operate within this or live or operate businesses in this market, they need strength. They need protection. They need rent control, not rent stabilization. In its best form, we are not allowed to have rent control in the state of California. And it is illegal in nearly every state in America. Rent control, which, as we know, the old school rent control, right, known as vacancy control, means that it don't matter if you leave. The amount of rent you're able to charge is capped. And that successfully operates in many parts of the world where it's not just, you know, at best, what we have is that if you're in a building and you're in a unit, they can only raise it 3%. Well, that's good, maybe. But if you know that the landlord can push everybody out through an Ellis Act by lying and saying they're going to convert it into a condo, which happens too often, or can harass a tenant, be slumlords, not fix broken windows, not fix the heat in the middle of the winter, you know, keep the air conditioner off in the middle of the desert in the summer, and otherwise harass tenants on a daily basis. If they know they can do that, well, then the person who's paying $1,000 a month, when Becky with the blonde hair pushing the stroller and walking the dog can pay $2,500 a month, they're sadly incentivized to push that person out, not to keep them, right? So it comes all down to putting those protective structures in order so that you can take land and not have it operate on this parasitic capitalism. It should not be a speculative thing where people just trade it like it's a stock, which is what's happening right now throughout America. And ensuring that the people, be they tenants who are residential or even commercial, can have some stabilized housing, have some stabilized expectation as to what their costs are, and are empowered against, you know, poor landlords. And I want to be clear. I say this all the time. Yes, corporate landlords are the worst. But mom and pop landlords can be bad, too. In fact, they can in some cases be even worse, because if Blackstone gets caught doing something horrible, they got a multi-million dollar class action lawsuit. They know, especially if a tenant has, I don't know, a record, or they're undocumented, or they're just really at risk and can't deal with the stress for whatever reason, they might be able to get away with it, because there isn't a strong anti-harassment ordinance in America. It barely exists in Los Angeles, and most of it is not being enforced. And that's simply, that is a policy choice that our elected officials make, to not put appropriate enforcement dollars in place. That is a policy choice, not to put protective policy in place. That has nothing to do with needing, which we do need, trillions of dollars to buy land, to convert land into community control, tenant ownership, and off the grid. That is needed. And we have the money for that because we got more than enough money. Anytime Ukraine needs more money, we just send it. We don't even think about it. That military budget's insane, right? But there are policies that can be put in place today that are minimal in cost that our elected officials won't do. Don't matter if they're Black, white, round, or a Martian. They're not doing it because they serve the same capitalist interest they serve the capital interest of the very people who are exploiting the crisis.
Yeah. Before you go, Damon, I want you to talk about that movement with Mark Reedy Thomas and the underground trains, and also the effort to buy them all.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, we had, you know, one of the major and incredible work and projects that we did was the Crenshaw Subway Coalition, which was the effort to have the train line that goes to our commercial corridor be underground, because it's the heart of our Black business. And we've seen the harm that took place in just its construction, let alone in its operation, and the harm that it will place from a safety perspective to our community, and to see a station at Mert. You know, one of the more frustrating things, and it is actually what broke what I will say was a personal professional relationship. That is to say, at that point, it was clear that Mark Reedy Thomas refused to do the one thing he needed to do, because we did everything right. We prepared the community. We brought the studies. We had the moment. And we just needed Mark Reedy Thomas to pass a motion on the Metro Board, or to even introduce a motion on the Metro Board, to see that undergrounding the line was a possibility.
And why did y'all want it underground?
So that the businesses would not be disrupted as greatly during construction. So they wouldn't be disrupted, so that the safety hazard would not exist, and the traffic nightmare that is inflicted on Crenshaw now would not exist after operation. And we knew the Metro had the money, because they spend the money on underground the line going through tar, dinosaur bones, and an active seismic area down Wilshire. So it wasn't a matter of money. It was a matter of priorities. And so it was very disappointing in about 2012, 2013, when the community does all the work, everything by the book, gets everybody on the same page, and where a politician articulates their support. And then the moment comes when you're at a board, and you can't do anything more as a community, as an activist, and that representative on the board refuses to even introduce the motion. You know, sad to say, and like I said, I don't think anybody wants to see Mark Reedy Thomas in jail, but he got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, and he refused to just accept his fate and negotiate well with him. And so I don't wish him ill will for that, but I will say that it was over 10 years ago when he, on that principle basis, whereby principally he articulated his support, principally he decided not to just introduce a motion, that we broke. And that's very unfortunate. And it was a missed opportunity. Now, with respect to the Crenshaw Mall, our 40 acres in a mall. That's right. That was the name of our campaign, and it will continue. We successfully, after the work that we've been doing with respect to the education of gentrification, had identified the Crenshaw Mall being in our background as a potential gentrification bomb that was going to be unleashed. The developer wanted to build nearly 1,000 units that were market rate, meaning they were completely unaffordable to the community, that was going to input more displacement pressure on the surrounding area by raising rents. Well, in the later part of 2019, early part of 2020, we became aware that the ball was being sold, and then it was going to be sold in May of 2000, or April, the end of April of 2020. It was to be sold to one of the worst developers in America, who literally were the closest development partners of Donald Trump, operating in Los Angeles. They're the reason why Wes Adams has been completely transformed. And you can see it, CIM Group. And we said, well, now is the time for us to be about not just trying to negotiate a good agreement, a good community benefits agreement, but actually have the community in control of its asset, collectively owned and operated, building an urban village built on principles of the solidarity economy, where we advantage cooperatives. And we had requirements for integration of preferred procurement locally and local hire. And it's a beautiful plan. And most importantly, it is a community plan. It is the people's plan. It wasn't us saying this is what it must be. It was us asking the community over and over again, what do you want to see? And as a nature of just the credibility we had and the work we'd been doing for, at that point, decades, It was a project that was in scale enough to capture the imagination of the nation. And so we engaged and successfully secured the largest amount of resources for a community-owned real estate project in American history, which permitted us to make a fully funded offer of $125 million by our mall, and even start to buy the Macy's as well. And wouldn't you know, because we are Black in America, that they refused to accept our offer, which had more money and better terms and was community supported. They instead gave it to a bankrupt individual who was of another complex and persuasion, who is clearly a conservative, and I need not dive into, because this is being recorded as to what he really said and did in our meetings with him as we spoke to him. And that deal was facilitated by Deutsche Bank, subsidiary DWS, one of the most corrupt banks on the planet, if not the most corrupt bank on the planet. And that just tells you how this long history of denying Black opportunity, let alone Black wealth development opportunity, being in control of spaces that we occupy is so ingrained into this real estate system, so ingrained into this American system that we operate within. Because we played by the rules, and then we realized the rules didn't apply to us. There were other rules that were unstated that didn't apply to us that included, no. We're going to continue exploiting your community. We're going to continue extracting from your community. We are not going to allow you all to be in control of this. We don't care how much money you have or how better your terms are.
I remember that struggle so bad, and the efforts that y'all put forth, and they still gave it to the guy. And what is he going to do with it?
Well, he's going to sit on it and try and sell it. But I want to be clear, we're not done. We're implementing a tactic where we're going to wait him out, put pressure on him, and force him to sell the community, make it clear that no one but the community can own them all.
And the struggle continues.
The struggle continues.
Appreciate that. All right, Rashid, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I just have a few things to say. Appreciate all that you bring to the table, Brother Goodman. It's extraordinary information and extraordinary efforts that you, the work that you're doing is amazing. And we definitely, as a community education network, support you 100%. And hopefully you could tell us what we could do to add to what you're doing. I just want to say this. When we had the pandemic, and it's piggybacking off of what you were talking about, they didn't allow us to do things. The only thing they allowed us to do is things that were essential. And when that was said, I immediately thought about this. Why are we not doing essential things anyway?
Exactly.
You know, it's ridiculous, and it ties into the value system.
Yes.
That you were mentioning. You didn't call it that, but it's the same thing. It's like, what do we value? And we have to change the value system. And like you were saying, we're going to be forced to at one point. And so my thing is, if money is the value, people are devalued. So what you're doing is excellent, and I'm just elated that we have brilliant people like you around to spearhead things like that. So, like I said, whatever contribution we can make in whatever way we can make it, it's a must that we do. So I appreciate everything that you're doing, brother. Really do.
And this is the last question. They're building so many apartments up and down Crenshaw.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't even know. I don't know how they qualify with no parking space.
Yeah.
But they're building them sky high. If people ever just go down Crenshaw, they could see it. Who's doing it? And what is going on? I mean, because, you know, like they're moving skyscrapers more south and to our community. Go ahead, David. And then we're going to talk about
it. So most of it is our outside speculators and investors who are building for, not for us, they're building it for somebody else. Some of it is affordable housing. And we're privileged that as part of our work within the Liberty ecosystem that we were able to get the site in partnership with an experienced community development corporation at 43rd Place in Crenshaw Boulevard that had formerly been the home of Toll Experience, that incredible nightclub. And so we are able to, in partnership, build in a fully affordable project that will be under on community controlled land and have ground floor community serving retail space. And that's the exception, though. That's not the rule. And even that project and process is very time consuming and challenging. But the vast majority of what you're seeing go up right now, including the new buildings, are not built for us. They're not built for families. They're not built to be affordable. And if there is any affordability, it's like 100 units and 11 of them are affordable. And that's even questionable. So that's part of our effort to be both about making sure that the land opportunities that exist are brought into community hands and are being built for the community. And it's part of our effort to ensure that, even on the land that is not ours, that it's our community. We have a right to demand that housing should be affordable to the people in the community, regardless of whether the community is building it or not. Last of which I'll say, which is just the most, heartbreaking, is that, two of the parcels that are being built on right now, the site of the old West Angeles Church of God Church, not the cathedral that's brand new right by the train line, but the old space. And they sold it to developers who were building creative office space that is not for us, have a history of engaging in discriminatory practices and housing that is not affordable to us. Did the people go to the church to put the money in the building fund so that their hard-earned labor, their commitment to the ministry, could be given away to money so outside speculators could cause more harm on the very community they live in? We got to talk to our churches. And while some do get in a situation that is just very difficult and impossible to navigate out of, some have a little bit more privilege and ability. And so if you have the ability to put up a cathedral, largest project on Crenshaw Boulevard built in a long time, you had an ability to sell that property to an affordable housing developer who was going to build housing that your parishioners could afford. You didn't have to give it to CIM Group. So we need to talk more about that and make people aware of that, because these parasites, they're knocking on the church doors just as they're knocking on grandmama's doors.
All right. Hey, Rasha Key, first of all, Damon, we want to thank you, Damon, for being here. I know you got to get some rest, brother. And we, I'll see you at DCCLA. I'll be coming down there to Crenshaw programs at Murray Park. But we really want to thank you and your organization effort to, first of all, educate people, mobilize people, organize people, and then confront, as we had taught through Coweta. I've seen your confrontations with Mark Wrigley, with others, and y'all have done an amazing job to continue the struggle for the many years you've been doing it. See, people be thinking we ain't doing nothing. And you'd be surprised at the organizations that come together at BCCLA, if it's Reverend Coolidge and all of them about the employment and service, the organizing of a union, the effort to get George McKinley elected, even brought him the idea with Aubrey. You're one of your mentors, holding politicians accountable. I mean, that Black United Front is there. They call it BCCLA, but it's a Black United Front. With Jackie, Ryan of Zambezi, a Marketplace, and I mean, it's just a beautiful thing what y'all doing. And we appreciate that. That Crenshaw should have been called Little Africa.
Yes.
And but they didn't want to give it that name, so they called it Crenshaw. Because that's how deep it was. But the middle class Negroes up there in the hills, you know, they'll come down and buy a dashiki then on Black History Month, but they won't get in the struggle. And we got to get that together. So Rashiki, tell Damien, he would need you to hold on because he's going to need a picture. This will be on YouTube. You can refer it to people. And then Rashiki, would you tell us what's coming on next week? And
yeah, I have one more question. Brother Damon, property over there, Nipsey Hussle, did he own that property? Do you know of that?
Yeah, my understanding was co-owned. I don't know exactly what the specific ownership structure was, but he and David Gross, and there's no development happening there. I'm not sure why.
Okay, and then were you ever affiliated with him in any kind of way?
No, not really. There have been many efforts, and there are many people who were working with both of us. Neither David Gross nor Nipsey Hussle. And I will say that, you know, there are, and you might consider Nipsey one of the very few generally conscious Black artists that we're pushing and, or I should say, talking about ownership. But I do want to differentiate that there are different understandings of what that means and different practices is what that is to make people understand what we're talking about. I don't own, and I am legally prohibited from profiting from any of our real estate endeavors. They're in a nonprofit. They're owned by the community through a community land trust where people can become members. We're putting together a structure where people can collectively invest, but not invest, you know, where one puts in $500,000 and the other puts in $1,000 and the person who puts in $500,000 has 500 times the number of votes or 500 times the votes. That's not collective engagement. That's not collective economics. Sometimes you have to put those structures together to make a deal happen, but that's not the goal. The goal is for us to collectively steward our land, to move forward, not the vision of one individual, but the vision of the community. And that takes a lot of work. It is exhausting. And you have to be rooted. You have to not just have the right mentality, and the right ideal, you have to put it in practice. And it is, as I said, very time consuming. And so that's how the work of Liberty Community Land Trust and the Liberty ecosystem, building on decades of work in the struggle, going back to Fix Expo, including Crenshaw Subway Coalition, that's how it's unique and how it's different. And, you know, so allow me to be the one that advocates that, you know, while it is always good and great and wonderful, if you can find a affluent Black or relatively conscious Black person who can do a project by themselves, that's not what I think leads to liberated communities. Not people doing for communities, people doing with community. And that's what we're doing. We're doing with community.
Appreciate it. Okay, so let me share the screen and let everybody know what's going on Wednesday. So we got Brother Kwabena Siddiqui, Ujaga Rasuli, and the topic is Ja Morant and Killer Rap Music. And anybody interested in joining that show could join right here on the homepage of Community Education Network. It's an open public forum to come on our podcast. All right, Professor Ra.
I'll call you tomorrow. I'm trying to get Brother Ayatollah, they've been going around the country meeting with gang members and community members about, you know, different projects to stop violence. And he'll let me know tomorrow if he can be there on the 26th. I think it is. That's a Monday.
26th today.
Huh?
You talking about next Monday?
Yeah.
Next Monday is, today is the 26th, the 29th.
Oh, that's African Liberation Day, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, well, all right. Well, that's fine. We'll take whatever.
I think we'd tune into African Liberation Day with the Culture Center because they have a bunch of, solidarity statements and unity perspectives about, you know, African Liberation Day that was started. They give you the history and everything. So, you know, I'll talk to you about it, Rashiki, sharing our screen with you.
Okay, good. All right, so each one teach one, Conscious Corner. Everybody have a good evening.
Thanks, Damon. Thanks.